Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Chris Pierce. I'm an alcoholic. Certainly want to say thank you for having me come up. I know we've Dale and I were kind of texting a while back, and kind of came back up. And we kind of dropped off the radar a little bit, and then we were picking back up. And he reached back out and said, "Hey, by the way, what are you doing in like 4 days?" honestly, it is a real honor and a privilege to be here and to be able to be of service. My sobriety date is January the 18th, 1998. I have a home group. I have a sponsor who actually knows he's my sponsor. And I have the privilege of sponsoring another young man in the program right now. So I love the fact that you read what you do. And Dale had sent me that, that this was part of what you guys do in this group, that you did that little piece off page 29. I think it's my last sponsor had actually really pointed that out, said it's probably one of the most important phrases in the entire book, is how you can share how you made your connection with your higher power that worked for you. And if somebody else can go, "Oh, well, that might work for me." And that's probably one of the most important things that I can ever share with somebody. Not just, "Hey, I drank this much. Hey, I did this stupid thing. Hey, I was arrested this time." And you know, that stuff's, a lot of us have that, but that's not necessarily what's really important today. And so I want to, I will talk a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me today. Again, as I mentioned, came in at a fairly young age, got pretty lucky with that. Felt pretty blessed to do so. But I came from a family that had an active alcoholic. My grandfather was active his entire life. I always thought granddad's red Solo cups tasted a little funny, but I always wanted another sip. So, meanwhile, he was usually referred to as that blank drunk out in the backyard. I never quite grasped that, what was going on, but I was born in South Carolina, a little small town. My parents had wanted me to kind of get a little more exposure to the world. And, so they decided to move from South Carolina, up to Virginia, up to Chesterfield. That was a very quick process for them, from start to finish, from the time they visited Richmond to the time that they found a house, found an apartment, went to South Carolina, packed their stuff, picked up, moved to Virginia. They were there 9 days later, full turnkey. So sometimes, you know, God just puts certain things in place and just says, "Hey, this is where you're supposed to be." And that's what they felt like that was for them. So with my grandfather's alcoholism, my father was one of those ones who just said, "Yeah, I just don't like it. I just don't want to have it around that much. I don't like, you know, I know what it has done to his nucleus family." And so he was never one. So, I mean, if we had beers in the fridge, they would stay there for months. I remember growing up, I was of that generation where if you got, you know, you got sick, they would give you the little, you know, squeeze the hot lemon and the honey and the little shot of Jack Daniels and your, you know, the little hot toddy when you're, you know, you might be 3, 4, 5 years old, but they're gonna give you this little bit and it's gonna knock you out for the night. And so I started having these little tastes of alcohol from a very early age. I mean, from growing up my whole life, I'd always had these tastes, but, my first full on blackout drunk was, I was 12. I came home one afternoon from school down to the neighbor's house, two doors down. And, sure, I'll drink that whole bottle of $3 cheap wine, you know, why not? I have an older half brother who is 8 years older than I am. And he was of the generation where he was grandfathered in the state of Virginia. So from the time he was 18 and 21 and so forth, he could always buy alcohol, which for me growing up was a great thing. Cause all I had to do was throw him a couple extra dollars, let him get whatever he wanted, but he would also buy whatever I needed or wanted as I was growing up. But I was never one to get right into it. I did not jump right into drinking. I didn't jump right into, I did use a little marijuana. There it is, done. Okay, I made my reference. It definitely played a part later. They went hand in hand, but I'm certainly going to focus on my alcohol because that's what started it. That's what continued it. And that's what finished it. And so there was a lot of mental struggles in my family. My mom, we found out years later, was bipolar. I dealt with a lot of depression growing up as a kid. I was the chubby fat kid who kind of got to tag along with I would always make friends with the most popular guy in school because that way I kind of got to go do things when he got invited to everything and he'd always want to bring his friend along. Well, I was kind of just the tag along. And I certainly felt that. So I certainly dealt with a lot of self-esteem issues, so dealt with a lot of depression. I still fight that. I still have a very low or a very loud negative talk, mental talk in my head. It still happens, even to this day. It's still there. I still question myself, why this? Why that? Why are you doing this? And so for years, I tried to just cover that up, blot it out, make it go away, shut it up. And a lot of times what would happen, it was just amplified. The more I would drink, it was like just turning the volume up. Every drink, as I'm pouring down, the volume's just going louder and louder until I could get to that point where I just wasn't thinking or feeling anything. My parents struggled being just the middle class family. My father was a career man with DuPont, just a factory guy, 40 years. Suit up, show up. He was the one that would leave an hour early for a 20-minute drive because he would rather be an hour early than a minute late. That's just kind of how he was. My mom, as I got older, some of her bipolar issues started to become a little more prevalent, and so she ended up not working for a while, stopped working. We never really had a lot, but we didn't do without necessarily either. We were just your solid middle class suburb family and in the burbs. Nothing spectacular. Now, as I mentioned earlier about my grandfather and my grandparents, or my grandmother, I should say my grandfather, I was talking about specifically, but in dealing with my grandparents, when I would go down and visit, I didn't quite understand what was going on and know all the details. I remember my parents talking a little bit about things and saying, you just deal with granddad when with granddad, and then you go deal with grandma. And I didn't understand why she slept upstairs and he slept downstairs, but that's what they did. I found out years later she slept upstairs with a pistol under her pillow and said, "I will shoot you dead on the spot if you come upstairs," because he was an active alcoholic and at one point had been violent and had put a knife to her throat. But being the good Southern family, she made him lunch every single day. My uncle was diabetic, and so my grandmother would make a unsweet tea pitcher for my uncle, and she would make a sweet tea for my grandfather every single day. They still use the same bank account. So if she needed to go to the grocery store, she would simply leave the check out on the counter. He'd come by, he'd sign the check, she'd take it in, get the groceries, come back home. They lived completely parallel but independent lives in the same household. They had nothing to do with each other than the fact that that's still her husband and she still makes him lunch every single day. They would go to the same church, sit in the same pew every single Sunday, were the first people in the door religiously. But it would be my uncle at the end of the pew, my grandmother sitting immediately right beside him, about 5 feet of space, and my grandfather all the way on the inside. So what I had found out over time was that they used to go and pick up my great grandmother to take her to church. And my grandmother got in a new car and they were going to go down and pick her up. Well, a lot of the limb, this was again country roads or whatever, and some of the branches went out. My grandma said, "I don't want to drive down the road and potentially scratch up my new car." My grandfather, being the good alcoholic and always handling things so well, said, "Well, if your car is more important than my mother, then beep you and da 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 da." So they kind of started their downfall, but they still stayed married. They stayed in the same house. They still stayed in the same church. So what that did for me, and the reason why I bring that up, what that did for me is it just said, you just kind of move forward. You just keep going on. Whatever's going on over here beside you and around you and behind you, well, that is what it is. That's just what you deal with. That's just life. Keep moving along. And so when my parents had their struggles at times, which they did, because any two human beings in a relationship, you're going to have struggles. It just happens. And I don't care if it's work, school, neighbors, relationship, just two human beings, always there's some form of conflict that will come up at some point. All that being said, as I mentioned earlier about my depression, about my struggles individually, I ended up having some suicidal communicate talks and phrases and so forth. And so my parents got really concerned for my well-being. And so they actually had me hospitalized in middle school for about 4.5 months, 12 days and 22 hours. not that it left any mark or anything, but I came out of that situation still. It helped some. It helped lay some foundation. I did learn a few things about myself. I learned some things, some coping techniques and so forth, but I still struggled. And as I got into high school, I got active in sports. I got active in theater. I got active in everything else except, oh, by the way, there's this thing called school and grades and class and homework and all those sorts of things. And I just didn't do that. As I went through, I mentioned earlier about that first real drunk that I had when I was 12, and drinking the whole bottle. That behavior would repeat itself. I had an episode when I was about 16, and I went with some friends up to a little weekend away up in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And at that time, it was, yeah, we're just here. We're all in a friend's house. We all got people around. If you have a couple drinks and you're underage, we'll just kind of pretend we just didn't, you know, it's all good. We got an eye on it. Guess you got to break that pattern. So I proceeded to have a bunch of drinks that evening and was pretty inebriated. And then the next door neighbor says, hey, well, let's go next door and take a shot. Okay. So they're literally in little row homes, and we go next door, and he opens up this bottle of green label Jack Daniels, and he takes the lid off and kicks a little swig, and he hands everybody and says, here, turn it up. Okay. Chug the whole fifth. Because every 16-year-old just chugs a fifth of, you know, but that's how I was. So from these very early stages, there was just something about it that once it hit and once it went up, that was it. I mentioned about not doing very well with the grades and stuff. So coming out of high school, I didn't think I was going to be able to go to college or anything like this. I literally just, my grades were so poor. I literally got out of high school by 2 points on the final exam. But I was looking to go into the military, which for all the mistakes I've made in my life, I still say not serving is probably the biggest regret that I have. Because I was a kid that at 18 basically needed to get his butt kicked. I needed to be put in a situation where they said, I don't care if you don't want to clean this, you're going to. I don't care if you don't want to run. I needed that structure in my life, and I didn't get it. And it showed itself in the next few years. I was actually surprisingly able to get accepted to college. And so when I found out, I applied for this little tiny school in the mountains of North Carolina, and I went down, and there was 800 students in there my freshman year, and there was about 450 my senior year. So small little school, but it was a perfect fit for me. It's where I needed to be. I found out that there was cocaine in that room, and there was acid in that room, and there was alcohol in that room. So not that I did the other things. I did not, but within 2 days of being on campus, I literally found out where everything was, and most of it was on my floor. So my drinking during this time would just kind of continue, and it would just be, I was that kid that just would go and do the weekend stuff. And then weekends became Thursdays, and Fridays and Thursdays and so forth. And then occasionally, oh, well, there'd be that one crazy Monday. Oh, football was on. So it's an excuse to just do a thing. But again, nothing really crazy. Oh, well, there was that little thing of, you know, my parents finding a fifth under my bed that was empty when I was in high school. And I said, oh, well, that's a reminder for me not to drink. It's a reminder for me that I needed to get another bottle is what it really was. I got lucky in that my parents actually found the half of the fifth that was in the trunk of my car before I flipped the car about a week later. Not drunk, completely stone sober, just happened to have an accident. Car rolled over. Everything's out. We're literally on the roof. Myself, my girlfriend, and another friend of ours are literally hanging from our seatbelts. So that's why to this day, I won't drive across a parking lot not wearing my seatbelt, because I feel like I'm going to fall out of the car. So, but I started having these little moments, little things popping up. My parents started seeing little things, and had one night where, again, in my good early alcoholic mindset and mentality, I had to pick up my dad from work. He was already working rotating shift work. He was getting off at midnight. And so I said, sure, you know, I'll meet my brother and some friends over to party, and I can have a couple drinks before I pick him up and won't have a problem. Well, Thank you. Needless to say, I did not pick up my father that night. My brother and another buddy drove me to my house. I remember literally kind of the car door opening up and a light coming on and picking my head up off the dashboard. And I'm in the passenger seat, just kind of picking my dashboard, and my brother getting in and going, "Mom's downstairs watching TV. There's no way I can get you past her." That's it. Well, the friend said, basically told my brother, said, "Look, go get your dad. I will take him in. I will deal with this." And he literally dragged me in the house and so forth. And so I wake up the next morning. I have no idea if I've been caught, how I got home, why I'm still dressed. Nothing, no clue. But I got to go to the bathroom. So I kind of get my clothes off, whatever. And I walk into the bathroom and I'm literally in there, hand against the wall, literally trying to keep myself upright. And turn around, I start to come out of the bathroom, and my mom's like in the doorway, like in the door. Like, I had enough wherewithal that it come back to me at that moment that said, "Don't breathe on her." So it's kind of one of those, like, I'm gonna give her the real like side hug. "Hey, good morning, Mom." And she's just like, "You still reek of alcohol." Busted. She's like, "Kitchen table right now, downstairs." Well, I'm like, I'm not going down by myself. Oh, he was here and he was here and Steve was there and every, I'm like trying to get myself out of as much trouble as possible because I literally had my driver's license for like a month. And they're like, "And you're going to lose it for a month." And so that was kind of my first real consequence with alcohol, if there really was such a thing. But being a kid and just getting your license and losing your license right off the bat, even if it's to your parents. Okay, it lasted like 3 days, and then it was go to the grocery store and get me this and come right home. So I got off the hook, and that played into me down the road of always seem to kind of just kind of get by, not quite getting the real consequence. And so it allowed me to continue that behavior for the rest of high school, and then again, as I mentioned, in college. My parents did about a year and a half later when they started seeing the. A little more of these little things kind of popping up, deciding, and again, finding the alcohol bottles and so forth, decided to put me in an outpatient rehab as a high school student. And so I did, went into this thing. I had to go once a week, and I went 9 months, didn't touch a drop. I'd gone about 6 months completely clean and sober, and then I used some other substances for a couple of days, but still went another 3 months, did not touch alcohol. But during that process, I was required to go to my very first AA meetings. And so I started going to the old St. John's Hospital in Richmond. It was a treatment facility, and I started going and visited a couple of meetings there. Again, I'm coming in, I'm 17 years old. I'm like, but what I was seeing, though, and what I was hearing, was the conversation about what it meant to be an alcoholic. And based off your reading on page 29, if you turn the page over to page 30, it says, "No real alcoholic ever recovers control." It says we've lost the ability to control our alcohol or to control our drinking. And I was doing that quickly. I was quickly losing my ability to control once I started. I didn't know what that meant at that time, but I knew I didn't drink like everybody else around me. And I actually, at that time, said to my best friend, she actually kind of came into the rooms a little bit before me, and her father had actually been active in the program. But I had actually said to her at one time in one of these little moments, I put my head down her lap, balled my up, saying, "I'm an alcoholic." I said it at 17. I just didn't really know what it meant. I learned. But I want to I want to punch in a little tiny little episode here, though. So, interesting little tidbit. It's coming through here. Sorry. It was a they got them on. They're on mute now. They're good. And hi guys, by the way. Nice to see you. I had a moment just in the last couple months that was that I got a little, I don't even know what you call it. It was just a memory, walk down memory lane. Very first exposure I ever had to any sort of 12-step program or meeting or anything in any way, shape, or form. I was probably 10, 11, or 12, somewhere in that range. And Mr. C across the street over in the corner became an alcoholic or was an alcoholic and got into early recovery. Well, his wife had talked to my parents because they're neighbors across the street and so forth. And they shared, my parents had shared, yes, his grandfather is an alcoholic and so forth. And so she said, well, I go to this Al-Anon meeting and they have an Alateen meeting and my teens go to the Alateen meeting. So she took me to my first meeting and it was an Alateen meeting. And I visited, and I was, again, I was 10, 11, 12, something like that. So I knew that there was something out there. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know any of the steps. I didn't know any of the truth. And I had no idea what the actual program was, but I knew that there was something out there that people that had a problem went to. For years, I would see Mr. C around the rooms of Richmond. Dave C, I don't know if any of you knew him. He passed away a few years ago, but I would always look at him like, know him from somewhere. And I never got a chance to make the connection with him. Well, again, as I mentioned, he passed away. He dealt with some outside issues, and so anyway, he passed. And I saw this post on Facebook about his passing. And his daughter had made this reference and said, "Wow, it's so sad." And somebody wrote said, "Yeah, I remember you guys growing up in Chesterfield, in Courthouse Green." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, you mean all these years I've been walking around him, and that was Mr. C from across the street?" And so I regret now not having a chance gone to him and said, "Hey, you don't realize this, but you and your wife, now ex-wife at that time, but you guys helped plant a seed for me." And so just a couple months ago, I was able to actually message his daughter and say, "Don't know if you remember me." Come to find out, she babysat me. She lives down in Texas now, but was able to reach out to her and said, "You don't realize that your family actually helped plant a seed for me. And that years later, I too landed here. Partly because you guys showed me that there is a way out. I didn't know what that was. I didn't know I needed that way out. I had no idea." So anyway, that's just a little blip. I just had this amazing conversation back where she was so excited. She actually ended up putting a post up on Facebook, did not name me, did not announce the program. She simply just said, was recorrected, was reconnected with someone who's just been able to celebrate 25 years of sobriety. And he had gotten this initial contact through my parents and stuff. And so it was just kind of really cool to go, wow, that's just pretty crazy. So anyway, a slight divergent there, but I ended up going through college, was able to graduate, actually did really well in school because it was much smaller classes. I didn't have a lot of homework, all these sorts of things. They were like, "We're not going to give you busy work." College was definitely a, I consumed a lot of alcohol, a lot. It became, even though it was a dry campus, those sorts of things didn't matter. I ended up getting an opportunity to go down to Atlanta for a job. And I will say that I'll back up one summer and say the summer between my junior and senior year in college, I got an opportunity to go down to Atlanta and work at this internship for the Georgia Shakespeare Festival. I'm down there and I'm a tech intern. I'm working backstage and building the sets and doing all the things, whatever. And it's literally just work all day, drink all night. Work all day, drink all night. It's all we did all summer. And we're college kids or people that just graduated college or young adults in their early 20s, 30s. And we just, it was a party atmosphere. That summer, my grandfather passed away. I was going to go see this concert. And I went and did my day's work and I left early to come back, get a shower. And I'm like, getting ready to run out the door, and my phone's ringing. I'm like, "I don't want to answer that. I want to go to the show." And I'm like, "All right," I grabbed it. And my dad goes, "Hey, granddad just passed away." Oh my gosh. I'm like, "Well, what can I do?" He's like, "Nothing." He said, "Funeral's going to be tomorrow. Just drive over." It was a couple hours from Atlanta over to South Carolina to where I was born. And he said, "Just come over tomorrow." Okay. So I'm sad, obviously. And I go back over and I tell my boss and said, "Hey," they're like, "You're going to still go to the concert?" And I'm like, "Yes." So I go to this big festival. And when I, as soon as I get out into the middle of this place, young lady kind of walks up the other direction. She's like, "Hey, have you ever been here before?" She's like, "Is this a good spot?" I'm like, "I don't know." She's like, "Hey, you want to, smoke a little something, do a little something here?" And I was like, "Sure, I'll go get some beers for us." Well, the way that, again, as I mentioned earlier, the way that once I kind of got started, once I kind of scratched that itch, I ended up that night literally urinating on myself out in public, completely just beyond any sort of healthy or rational state. And thankfully it had rained, so you couldn't tell that I had done that. So we were all completely soaked out here, but I proceeded to go out and get in a car and drive 45 minutes back across down through downtown Atlanta, through the interstates and so forth to get myself back to where I was staying. This is what I did. As my drinking progressed, I stopped doing that because from the time I was 16, and I mentioned to you earlier that I started drinking, as I would drink and drive, I would not drink and drive, I would drink and then I would drive. And to this day, I stand here in front of all of you going, I don't know if I have a body count. I don't know if I've killed anybody because I blacked out. I would leave here and I would arrive here and I would have no idea what happened in between. I would literally come to in my parents' driveway and go inside. I don't know if I've ran anybody off the road. I don't know what happened. I don't know. It's a scary thing that when I was many years into the program and many years removed from a drink, when that finally dawned on me that I went, I don't know what I did when I drove. I don't know how I got from A to B. I don't know what I left in my wake. That's a real honest and scary and sobering thought to think about. Because that's how I would drink. As I got to the end of my, towards the ends of my alcoholism, or towards the ends of my drinking, actually, not my alcoholism, I still have that. But towards the end of my drinking, I would get to a point where I didn't want to drive because I knew I was going to drink till I passed out. I wanted to be wherever I was going to be because I just want to be here so that I don't have to worry about going out and getting in the car, because that's just an annoyance. Honestly, I didn't want to have to be bothered with having to try and get myself home safe and anything else. But I had that moment in Atlanta and I drove 45 minutes back across town and I'm dating, seeing a young lady or whatever. And I'm just kind of like, yeah, you're going to do what I want you to do with me right now. I can't stand up right now, but I don't care. I put myself in situations and I took advantage of people. And I threatened other people's safety. I did not physically abuse her. I will say that. Did not do that. But I was not gentlemanly. Let's just put it that way. A lot of rudeness, crass, whatever. And so, I've had to own it. I've had to just be honest about that. That whole, I go back to school for one more year. I get out of school. I come right back. I get an opportunity to come back down to Atlanta. The situation I came back to in Atlanta, I basically was partying for a living. I had hair down to the middle of my back. Literally, we were hired. We had Bacardi as a sponsor who gave us alcohol and said, here, go home and experiment so you can sell this better. I'm going down into the Buckhead area, which is kind of the party downtown area of downtown Atlanta. And I'm literally out there with models walking around selling alcohol, trying to promote alcohol. I'm going, I went to college for this. This is amazing. I mean, the problem was, is that whenever I was doing this, I was really fighting hard at that time to control what I was consuming while I was out. A, I was working, but B, I knew I had to get myself home and I knew how it was. But I certainly lit the fuse every single night I was out on the job. I would go out and we would do these pool parties for, we worked through a radio station. We would do these kind of what they call a little remote. So they call in and say, hey, we got something special going on over here. Well, I'd show up at these things and people are like, oh, we want you to party. Here's beers. And they're like, the customers are giving us thing. We want you to party with us. I'm like, because again, if I start, I knew where I was going to go. I ended up getting out of that situation and coming back to Richmond. At that point, my drinking was at a point where we would literally party for every Monday was our day to party because we worked on Saturdays and Sundays. So we would start at noon and it was drinking all day, smoking substances, drinking all night, smoking substances, drinking all night. Everybody else goes and passes out. I go back into my room and I keep on drinking, keep on doing my other stuff. So even after a full day of drinking whatever, I was consuming probably about 3.5 cases of beer a week just of maintenance. This was just as how my day ended, was just to a 6-pack plus every single night. It's just I needed that just to go to sleep. And so I ended up getting out of that situation. I came back to Richmond, and my goal in life was to be a bar back. Because I literally thought, oh, well, if I'm around it all the time, well, then nobody will know why I smell like alcohol. Oh, it's because of work. I'll fast forward through this simply to say I ended up in a situation where in December of 1996, I got a little bit of a judicial encouragement that I needed to address my alcohol. Oh, by the way, yes, when you drive, you should have your headlights on. So, because again, oh, I can just do one or two more before I walk out the door. One's good, but two's better. And now I'll walk out the door and try and drive myself back home one more time. And needless to say, they didn't like that. And so I had to attend ASAP classes. And again, there was a requirement of now mandatory meetings, mandatory AA meetings. But I would walk in and I would sit there in the corner and I'd be, I'm Chris and I'm here because the court sent me. Just all this angst. You know, I'm young and I'm just angry that I'm there. And at the same time, you guys are saying something. And I'm hearing something. And it's sitting in there, whether I want it to or not. It's sitting in there. And I remember this one lady, God bless her, Monica. It was one of those times where, again, I said, I'm Chris. She just walks over to me after me. And she's kind of, ever so gently, puts her hand on my shoulder and just says, you can just say your name's Chris. We know why you're here. Give me my angst back. You know, I'm like, you know, I want to be angry here. And she just said, it's all good. It's all good. You just keep coming back. Whatever you need to do, we'll sign your paper or what, if, whatever it is. You know, she was extremely gracious with me because I was not with myself at that moment. But I ended up doing a lot more meetings than I was required to. But I would also leave those meetings and pick up on the way home. I never went to a meeting inebriated, never drank before a meeting, but I picked up on the way home from many. I also learned through that ASAP program that if I stop consuming on Tuesday, I can always urinate clean on Thursday. Because I was still trying to manipulate the system. And so, you know, I was in a situation where I was facing 90 days in jail if I, you know, if I had a dirty urine. And, you know, they were checking it. And there were times where I was out in the community where I was working. And next thing you know, I turn around and there's one of the counselors standing in front of me going, what's in your hand? Oh, whoa, well, why are you out here? He goes, because we know a lot of our people are out here. It's one of those little concert series. I used to work for a thing setting up like concerts and music and stuff. And so I'm out there working, running sound and stuff, but they're coming out, checking out for people in the crowd that are not supposed to be there. But I ended up seeing the situation where I'm going, I'm really having a problem with this. Because what was happening for me at that point is I would go back to my apartment that my wife at the time would call my cave. Because I had all these tapestries up over the windows, so there was no natural light coming in. It was just I was in this dark little room, and I wouldn't keep the lights on. And I would come back in, I would sit down, and I'd say, all right, I'm going to have a couple drinks. I'd have a beer, and get up, and I'd go back, and I'd get another one. It's about from here to where the kitchen is here, about the distance. And I'd go back, and I'd get another one. I'm like, man, every 10 minutes, I got to get up and get a beer. So in my good alcoholic mindset, I said, well, let's just grab two at a time. So I bring two at a time out to the desk. Well, my thought is, well, I don't want that one to get warm while I'm drinking this one. So I'll just chug this one and then I can drink that. Well, now it's 10 minutes later and I got to go get two more. Come back. Well, I don't want that one to get warm while I'm drinking. So I chug that one and I drink the other. Well, now I go back and say, well, let's start grabbing three at a time. Well, I don't want those two to get warm while I'm drinking. So I would chug it and turn around and I'm an hour in and I'm 12 back in. I mean, it was just no time. And that's how my drinking would go. That's how I would progress almost every time I would pick it up. It was just, we talk about that mental obsession, that physical allergy. That allergy absolutely had me full bore at that point. I ended up, again, I was going to these meetings, and I can say that now because God, thank God that I have gotten to this age in life, but I would walk into meeting and I would look at people my age and older, and I would go, yeah, I don't relate to that. You know, you're talking about losing a wife and losing kids and losing a career and losing jobs. And, you know, I'm sitting here wearing pit stained t-shirts and steel-toed boots and make working an hourly job, pulling overtime every week to barely pay a, $300 a month rent. I just didn't, I didn't get what you guys were doing. And I'll, at that time, I could only see your outsides. I couldn't hear your insides. I could only see your outsides. And I ended up having a young man who came in to tell his story in a meeting like this and do the very similar, like what you said, how he made his connection. He got there and he said, "Hey, look, yeah, I got sober at 19 because I wrecked cars and cheated on girlfriends and I got DUIs." I'm like, "Ooh. Ooh, I know that story." And it was a connection for me. It was somebody that I could relate to that could go, "Okay, I get it." And so I made a semi conscious effort to pick up a white chip that night. And I did. I picked up a white chip and I said, "Okay, I want to see if I can try and actually not do this thing." And it was the night before New Year's Eve, 97. And about 2 weeks later, I had friends of mine that were getting married. And I was like, "Well, I can't not drink at Brian and Amy's wedding. I mean, this is Brian and Amy's wedding. I mean, it's Brian and Amy's wedding. I mean, this is what we're going to do." And so, because it's been 2 weeks now, I've got to be ready for Saturday. So it means I got to prime the pump. So I got to start on Wednesday. And I had to drink Wednesday. And I had to drink Thursday. And I had to drink Friday so I could be ready to drink the way I drink on Saturday. And I'm sitting there Friday night with a friend who'd come in from out of town, from Ohio. And she's sitting there, and I'm holding this white chip. I'm going, "See, AA doesn't work. See, the program doesn't work." Mind well, this was a beer at the time. And she's just looking at me, just shaking her head, like, "Oh my God." Because she's seeing full-blown wet alcoholism right in front of her. And what I didn't know at the time was that her husband was about 3 years sober. And so she lived this from the other side. And she is just like, "Wow." And so I attended that wedding and went into it with the phrase that I personally copyrighted that all of you stole from me, which is, "I'm not getting drunk tonight. I'm just going to have a couple." Because I did that. That was me. Y'all just took that from me, but I came up with it originally. And so I did. I went into that night and said, "I'm not going to get drunk. I'm just going to have a couple." Well, of course, once I get going and I scratch that itch, by the time I'm done, I'm putting myself in another situation that I shouldn't be putting myself in with a half gallon under my arm walking out the door. So I wake up the next day and it's hit. And I'm just like, "Oh, wow." And I end up having my company Christmas party that evening at a country club, black tie. I have my girlfriend at the time with me, who, oh, by the way, was not with me the night before at the wedding or afterwards. And she could just see it, something was off, and she's looking at me. And my parents are at this event because they had been invited. And they're seeing something's just off. Maybe because it's January and it's like 20 degrees, and I'm standing outside with sweat rolling off of me. Because I'm in full on detox. I'm like, "I don't want to look at a drink. I don't want to look at, I mean, I'm feeling so bad at that moment." I never felt mentally and emotionally probably more beat up than I did at that moment. We talk about our jumping off place. I was at that spot right then. And then my boss says, "Oh, by the way, our employee of the year." You talk about turning the knife in my back. I couldn't. I'm like, "Here I am, probably the most undeserving of human beings, and you want to call me up and give me an award like this." And I end up going into work the next day, and he looked at me and he said, "What's going on with you? What's happening?" He said, "You're," he said, "I called you up last night. I named you employee of the year, and your eyes were just dead." I was like, "Yeah." And I said, "Joe, I gotta go. I just gotta go home. I've gotta leave. I can't explain it right now. I just gotta go. Because I wanted to go home and I just wanted to be asleep. Because when I was asleep, I didn't have to think about it. I didn't hear it, didn't feel it. Didn't, it just, it was the only time when that, all those voices shut off completely. It's when I could finally sleep." And I got home and I got a page, again, name aging myself here, but got a page on a pager from a friend who basically said, "Call her." And so I called her up and she said, "You will be at my house at 6 o'clock tonight." I said, "What's going on?" She said, "You will be at my house at 6 o'clock tonight." Okay. I go and I fall back to sleep, and I'll wake up a little bit later and I drive over to her house and walk in the door, and I get like a half step in the door, and she grabs my hand, she yanks me out the door, and she brings me out and sits me in my car, and she said, "It stops now." Because the thing for me, when I mentioned about my self-worth issues and I mentioned about my depression issues, I mentioned about that negative self-voice, the biggest thing for me was, as long as I'm not hurting other people, then hurting myself is okay. That was always my thing.
Let me sure when I keep going, I'm cut off right
Can
then.
you mute, buddy?
Okay.
So it's she basically said, "Your actions are now affecting other people. Your actions are now about to bring a whole bunch of hurt to a whole bunch of people if you don't stop this." And it was a moment for me that I completely broke down. And I realized at that moment that I had completely lost control, that I could not control this, that once I started, I was going to have another. If I had one, I was going to have another. If I had another, I was going to have another. There was no stopping at that point. Once I scratched that itch, I was done. And so I got a phone number for a counselor. I went and saw this counselor the next day. She got out of me enough to go, "I think this may be alcohol related." Because I realized that there were certain things that legally I could not tell her, or she would be obligated to pass that along to certain authorities because of some of my actions in the previous days. And so that young man that had shared his story was the one phone number I had. And I called him up and I said, "I don't know what to do." He said, "Let's go meet for coffee." And he and I had coffee. I will say that also that night before he and I met, my girlfriend came in and she and I sat down. And I'm going to wrap this up with that part. She and I sat there and I had to go, A, I'm an alcoholic, and B, I just cheated on you. And my roommate at the time, who I'd met through ASAP, who was only keeping this apartment so he could continue his affair going on, was in the other room. And I told him, "Please don't be here right now. I've got things I need to deal with." Well, I'm talking to my girlfriend and I tell her these two things. She gets up, she walks out on me. Big surprise. I am at this point full on just sobbing. I have hit what I, God willing, I hope is the lowest low I ever hit. Because I really felt like here's everything that I had ever hoped and wanted for that I had brought crashing down on top of. And in a moment of completely undeserved grace, I got a phone call from that girlfriend out on the sidewalk. And she said, "Meet me outside." And I get up, and my roommate's coming, "What's going on?" I'm like, "Dude, just go do your thing. Just go away from me." And I go outside and I stand on the sidewalk, and my girlfriend looks at me and she goes, "I don't know what this is going to mean for us. I don't know where we go from here. I don't know what I can do with this situation, but I think you need a friend right now more than you need an enemy." This December, we'll be married 23 years. So we still have our stuff because, again, two humans in a relationship, but she has walked through this with me. And so I had that meeting with the young man the next night. He said, "I really suggest you do 90 and 90." And I went through and I went Friday night. That was a Wednesday I met him. I went that Friday. I picked up another white shift. Even though it was that previous Sunday was my first day not drinking, but that Friday night I picked up a white shift. I had a young man said, "Hey," I had a guy I knew. He said, "I'm going to take you to a meeting tomorrow morning." I said, "Okay." He said, "Saturday morning." I said, "Yep." He said, "I'm going to pick you up at 7 a.m. I'm like, "I'm sorry, what? What time did you say?" And he picks me up at 7 a.m. He takes me to a meeting and he's like, "Okay." And at the end of that meeting, he buys me one of these. And he said, "If you're not sure if you should be here, go home and read chapter three. It's called More About Alcoholism." And I went home and I got here and I skipped ahead and I got to this chapter three. And most of us have been unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. No person likes to think he's bodily and mentally different from his fellows. I could read this probably verbatim for the first page and a half, because I've read this a few times. But that we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. I literally sat there and read that and went, crap. Because I knew this is what it was. And I knew it's where I needed to be. And I got up and I went to another meeting right after that. And I stood in that meeting and I said, I'm Chris and I'm an alcoholic. And that's exactly how it came out. And that night, I went out back to my work. And we're out in a situation where we used to do special events or whatever. I am 7 days, 6 days removed from a drink. And a young lady walks in and says, hey, anybody want a beer? And where it talks about that, like, we'll put out of our mind the pain and suffering of even a day or a week or a month ago. I can, to this day, see the condensation running off that bottle that she was holding. Because I was right there going, man, that's what I want to get. And the only thing that saved me at that moment, and this ties into your page 29, I was really lucky that from a very early age, my parents had always given me a belief in what was right or wrong. And I always had a belief in a God. I was really blinded because I saw my grandparents and what they did going to church. And I saw church and God as one for a long time. And I was able, through a lot of work and process and actually sitting down with a pastor who I found out had a brother that was in recovery for like 3 hours over two different sessions, understand that there's the church and there is God, and they're two separate things. And so it allowed for me to realize I don't have to be in a specific building on a specific day of the week, a specific time, to do a specific activity to show anybody else that I have faith. That has nothing to do with it. There's something in my core that I've been lucky enough and blessed with that's just there, that it's that belief in my higher power. And that night when that lady's standing there holding that, and I went, I don't want to do this again, but I don't know what to do. I was really lucky because after that second meeting when I said I was an alcoholic, I had a bunch of young guys that came up to me and said, hey, you know what you're going to do? You're going to be of service tomorrow morning. We're going to stand out in front of a meeting. We're going to be there at 9 o'clock. I'm like, that means at 9:30. He said, yep, and we're going to be there at 9 o'clock, and we're going to stand on the front door, and we're going to shake hands, and we're going to say good morning. And it's going to be all of us. And there was a line of like six of us. Good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. And like people had to go through a gauntlet to get into this meeting because of all of us. And they said, well, we have a home group on Tuesday night, and you're going to come, and you're going to be there. We open up the doors at 7 o'clock. It's 8 o'clock. And he said, yep, we're going to be there at 7 o'clock. We're going to stand at the door. And we're going to shake hands. We're going to put out books. We're going to set up chairs. We're going to do some service work. And we're going to do it shoulder to shoulder. It's like, I thought I read that somewhere. I said, yeah. Because I'm not going to ask you to do anything I'm not willing to do myself. Because the young man that bought me this big book and said, go home and read chapter 3, I saw him at that Sunday meeting, and he said, did you read that chapter? And I said, yeah. He said, well, so did I. Because I'm not going to ask you to do anything I'm not willing to do in this program myself. And I got to see the actions. I got to see the service. I got to stand beside all these guys that became my sponsee brothers and my original sponsor, my original grand sponsor. And we're standing there, side by side, doing this, welcoming people, not understanding. I'm going, I got no idea why this is, why I'm shaking hands, what I'm doing here. But that home group showed me an opportunity where I could come in and I could get active in a group, and I could have a business meeting, and I could have positions, and I could serve that group. And I joined that home group on my 17th day sober. And until the pandemic, it was the only home group I had for 23 years. Because of the pandemic, we ended up closing, and we did not come back afterwards. And so I moved over. And so I have my second home group in 25 years. Our home group, Bon Air Big Book Study on Wednesday nights, are getting ready to celebrate its 40th anniversary as a group. So if you're free on September 9th and want to come down and join us for potluck, we'd love to have you. Just a little plug for the home group. But I would go and meet my sponsor beforehand. And this was one of my regular committed meetings. And now I made it my home group. But I was 12 years sober, and I was sitting there ready to pull my hair out. As you can see, there's not a lot there, but it's kind of thin. But I was absolutely squirreling, 12 years sober. Going, what's going on? There's got to be more to this. I knew that there was service. I didn't really even know that there was service beyond the home group. I knew New York existed. I knew that the books came from somewhere. I knew the magazine came from somewhere, but I had no idea, no clue about General Service. I even had the DCM for our district was an active home group member and would come into our business meeting, would tell us about what was going on. Every time Steve would start talking, I'd be like, is he done yet? I just completely tuned him out. And then one day he walked in and said, hey, if you've ever thought about being of service at the district level, we're going to have elections next month. So come on out and be of service. And it was a punch in the gut because at 12 years sober, I was just as bat crazy as I had been the day I walked in. And I saw the same thing from an early sponsor I had that said he was 5 years sober on the floor in the fetal position, reaching up to the desk to try and pull himself up. And he's holding the pistol and he's going, do I bring the pistol down to me or do I actually pull myself up? And so when I read in the book and it says, this is a design for living that works in rough going, I went, that I relate to. Because I can be removed from a drink and I can be removed from alcohol and I can still have all the stuff going on. And what's helped me with that is I've always had a home group. I've always had a sponsor. I've been lucky enough to sponsor other men. I've done the service work. At 12 years, I walked into that district meeting and they said, we're going to have elections. Anyone willing to serve for DCM, please raise your hand. I went, I'll do it. What is that? I had no clue what it was, but I just threw my hand up. And they were like, okay, we're going to elect Robert. And they're like, all right, ADCM. And I threw my hand up. So what is that? So we're going to put Tate in that position. I said, okay, we've got secretary and treasurer. I said, you don't get it, folks. I have to do something. And myself and a young lady went out in the hallway because they had treasurer and they had secretary. And I looked at her and I said, I failed English so many times. You do not want me as your secretary. And she said, I can't add if I have my shoes on. I cannot be a treasurer. Of course, we walk in and God says, guess what? I got to serve as District 44 secretary and she got treasurer. And I went through and I did 6 years worth of service work at the district level up through DCM. I rotated out of that and I came back and I was sitting in my home group. And I've been there for, you know, I've probably been out of district for about 6 months or so. And I was just like, guys, who's our GSR? Got about that kind of sound at the home group level. It was like, okay, well, we're a group. We should have, we're one of our responsibilities as a group is to have a GSR and to go and carry our voice. Fine, I'll do that. So after serving as DCM, then I became a GSR for the first time. And those of you that have been in the service structure understand that's a little bit kind of out of the loop or a little backwards, but that's what it works. It says it's suggested to serve as a GSR first. And I'm serving as a GSR and I'm at the area assembly and they had elections there. And Marianne F. got elected as our area chair a few years ago. And I walked back to the back of the room and said, hey, congratulations. You know, that's so awesome. She said, yeah, great. Have you ever thought about serving at the area level? And I looked at her and I went, I have two of these. Use them where you can. Because for me, probably the most impactful statement in this entire book, as much as the ones I read earlier on page 30, one of the most impactful statements for myself and my recovery is at the top of page 77. And it says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And my original grand sponsor saying we're going to stand outside of a meeting and shake hands. We're going to have a door open early. We're going to do readings. We're going to set up cookies. We're going to put out chairs. I'm going to step up at 12 years and go, I'll be a DCM, not even knowing what it is, but I'll just do it. I took an opportunity at the area level to serve as the IT coordinator. I got another opportunity to serve again as the website coordinator. I've currently got an opportunity now where I'm serving as the area archives committee chair. We are writing a new history book on the history of AA, which we're hoping we're going to have published within the next couple months. Former home group member up here, Gary, has been actively involved in writing that new book. So I certainly want to say a thank you for him because I know he's local. Really, I have been so blessed over the last couple of years to be able to be of service because I cannot explain. For those of you who have been kind of like, I'm not sure what I want to do or where I fit, there's workshops that need to be done. There's coffee makers and even setting up books, going out and doing, being a GSR, there's something about service, about truly, when I get out of myself and I truly look at Billy and I say, I want to help this guy. I really want to just do whatever I can to make sure that he has an available opportunity, whether it's on an individual level or whether it's a group level, whether it's a program level. It's what I have found is the closest thing I've been able to be able to shut that quiet, all those voices. Because when I just truly say I just want to help with no expectation and not worried about what I'm going to get out of it, but I generally just want to help somebody else, I can't explain what that does for me, but it is something that I just, it just completely stops all of that negative talk for just a moment. Now I can come right roaring right back, especially when somebody questions me and says I'm not doing it well enough, because my little ego gets in the way at times. Absolutely. But there's just something about it. So if you want to stand out in front of a meeting and shake a hand, I'll tell you, you want to change your entire day. Seriously, stand out in front of a meeting and just say good morning or good evening to people. Your entire mood will change just greeting people. It can be something that simple. So I don't care if you serve as a at an area level, if you serve at a group level, if you, whatever it is, just put your hand out. Because again, I have two of them. I don't know where to use them. I don't know how that's the best way to use them, but I'm willing to make them available. Like being asked to come up here and be a part of this, I truly feel blessed, and I appreciate you guys having me up. Thank you.